Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi there, and welcome to Explaining History podcast. And the thing I'm going to be talking about today is the relationship between the Supreme Commander of the Allied Powers occupying Japan from 1945 to 1951, General Douglas MacArthur, and the Japanese people themselves. And in the middle is the discredited and disgraced figure of Emperor Hirohito. And this period is racked by some complex Cold War politics, but also some deep cultural politics within the kind of the post-feudal world of Japan. And it's there's some really intricate things happening here that, if you follow them, make an awful lot of sense as to kind of MacArthur's decision-making and the outcomes that ensue. Now, as you may have detected in past podcasts, if you go way back to some of the stuff I've talked about, the Pacific War, I'm no innate fan of MacArthur, and a great many of his contemporaries were not. But it does appear that many of the decisions he made in the post-war occupation of Japan were rather astute, and he was, if he had a talent at all, it was listening to the right people. He was able to swat aside many of the inaccurate and rather racist views of the Japanese that had been drawn up by the OSS, the Office of Strategic Services, and the various sort of intelligence arms that he had at his fingertips during the war. And instead, he listened to his good friend, Brigadier General Bonner Fellers, who had done his research, who's had family members related to and married into senior Japanese diplomatic dynasties, and could give a realistic position. And that was that, firstly, the Japanese must be defeated conclusively, comprehensively, and overwhelmingly in order to shatter the myths that the Japanese people had been told about their army and about their emperor. Really, the emperor was descended from godhood. But he was also advised against getting rid of the emperor, putting the emperor on trial. Now, obviously, the Chinese, the British, the Australians, the Koreans, the Malays, and a whole range of other occupied peoples from across Asia were very keen on seeing Hirohito hanged for his part in war crimes. MacArthur claimed that he had investigated Hirohito's link to war crimes and couldn't find any evidence, which is obviously nonsense. The evidence was abundantly clear, particularly after 1943, a decision by Hirohito that no prisoners or witnesses to atrocities must be allowed to survive, which led to the killing of Allied prisoners and also more significantly and on a vastly greater scale, the killing of occupied Asian peoples. In Forgotten Wars by Harper and Bailey, the statistic is sobering that for every one Allied prisoner killed, 100 occupied Malays, Chinese, Filipinos, Koreans, etc. Were murdered. So the suffering of Asia at Japan's hands is really, really quite staggering. The decision by MacArthur in August 1945 to land at Atsugi Air Base and announce himself as the conqueror of Japan and to accept the surrender of the Imperial Japanese Army showed kind of partly MacArthur's recklessness, partly his boldness, his flair for drama. But it had a profound effect. There were 300,000 Japanese troops there at the time, all still armed. MacArthur is escorted by a small number of US soldiers, and they are surrounded by the Japanese. And he essentially accepts their officers' surrender, and then his men begin to disarm the Japanese troops then and there. And this has a kind of a profound psychological impact. And it also showed the Japanese at Atsugi that MacArthur was not going to be a bloodthirsty conquistador who was there to exact a terrible price from the Japanese, that he was there to be in some ways constructive and to be conciliatory. MacArthur had a clear plan for Japan, which I'll talk about in a moment. And he also was granted by Truman greater devolved powers over Japan than Truman himself had in the USA, and that any commander of post-war American forces had. The degree of control that generals such as, say, Patton in occupied Germany had in 1945 pales in comparison to the powers granted to MacArthur. MacArthur was an imperial viceroy of the kind of standards of the East India Company. However, the British viceroys of India had long been forced to compromise and cooperate with the Congress Party and other forces within India in a way that MacArthur simply didn't have to do when he was in Japan. Now, Fellers advised MacArthur, "You cannot put the Emperor on trial. If you do, you will create a kind of a people's war in Japan against the occupying forces. You'll need 1 million US soldiers in order to occupy the country." Perhaps this was an overestimate, but these are the kind of figures that MacArthur fed back to Truman. Truman, like Roosevelt, had despised MacArthur, and the feeling was pretty mutual. MacArthur presented Truman with his apocalyptic picture. Truman would have been happy for Hirohito to go on trial, but he realised that faced with the possible consequences, that this was not something that could happen. And another possible consequence would have been outright turmoil and civil war in Japan, and an opportunity for the Soviets to exploit that. At a time when Soviet intentions in Asia are known to be hostile, but in not quite understood in what ways these would manifest themselves, any opportunity for Soviet expansion needs to be carefully checked. MacArthur's intention was to sweep away Japanese feudalism and create a modern-style constitutional government of free press, civil rights, and create the conditions for free market capitalism to develop, but with an emphasis on social welfare that was really a kind of a legacy of the New Deal. MacArthur himself had been an opponent of the New Deal, but could clearly see its uses in staving off the possibility of communism. And the first step was the Declaration of Humanity. This was the emperor's admittance that he was not a god or descended from a god. He was, in fact, a human being. And that meant that Japan's mission in the world to rule supreme over Asia as a conquering power was no longer a possibility and had been deeply misguided, had been a great mistake. Now, this Declaration of Humanity isn't drafted by Hirohito or any of his royal court. It's, in fact, drafted by an American officer in MacArthur's staff, Lieutenant Colonel Harold Henderson, who was part of the Occupying Powers Education Department. And simply, he creates a two-paragraph reading which said that there would be a world with new ideals and humanity would prevail above nationalism as the great god. Ties between us and the nation do not depend on myths and legends, and do not depend upon on the mistaken idea that the Japanese are of divine descent, superior to other peoples and destined to rule them. They are the bond of trust, of affection, forged by centuries of devotion and love. So the essence of Japan as a kind of a hierarchical family society with the emperor at the head, that's retained. But the idea that this militaristic, imperialistic and racially superior peoples were able to march across Asia ever again was swept away. And with this coming from the emperor, it helps MacArthur to structure this kind of constitutional revolution that he intended to bring about. The advice coming directly from MacArthur's office was that if Hirohito wished to avoid the possibility of a war crimes tribunal, then he needed to present himself as a modern constitutional leader, a king, an emperor on the standard of a kind of a European monarch. This meant that he could apportion the blame to his generals. He could suggest that they were the people who had been responsible for atrocities, for the planning of a preemptive war. The fact is that Hirohito knew all about plans for war and approved of them heartily, and he was deeply involved in the decision-making as it pertained to war crimes and atrocities. But managing to kind of sidestep this and to keep the emperor's name out of these kinds of difficulties was really important, not just for Hirohito, but for MacArthur as well. Hirohito knew that if he did abdicate, he would be in danger of being, he would be far more vulnerable to being arrested. For a while, he considered abdication as the job of rulership was not a particularly pleasant one for many times. For
ready to pop the question, the jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
For him. But he was, it was important that he be retained as a figurehead. One interesting aspect of the end of the war are the attitudes of the Japanese towards returning soldiers. Some 5 million returning soldiers and colonists from across Asia come back to Japan, 1945, 46, 47. And in those years, they are treated with contempt and disgust. Quite different from the returning soldiers who make it back to the Reich at the end of the war. These are soldiers not only who have lost and therefore have let Japan down and have failed Japan and have not done the honourable thing in the field and taken their own lives, but also by the later 1940s, evidence of Japan's atrocities across Asia are unmistakable. And they are fully accessible by the Japanese people. The Western news agencies and new Japanese news agencies report them, and the war crimes trials that take place actively report them. There are American, British and Australian military policemen scouring Japan for war criminals throughout this period and arresting them and trying them and executing them. So the sense that Japan had been suffered a terrible dishonour by the actions of her armies, and there was an immense amount of national shame over this, meant that returning soldiers were often treated often shunned and treated as pariahs. And this is perhaps because there was a collective national guilt, that there was a sense that perhaps the nation had been on some level involved and complicit in this. And if you read Japan 1941 by Eri Hotta, there is a widespread enthusiasm for Pearl Harbor after it happens, after several years of fuel shortages, rationing, and almost like a vice being placed around Japan by America due to Japan's various transgressions in Southeast Asia. There is a collective cheer when the news of the Pearl Harbor attack happens. So Japan's militarism had widespread popular appeal, at least at the beginning of the war, as very often these things do, and but Japan, by 1945, has been brought to its knees through bombing and starvation in a way that even Germany hadn't by that point. Part of the whole reason for creating the Japanese co-prosperity sphere, the Japanese Empire, during the war, was that Japan wasn't self-sufficient and hadn't been for some time. She had a population of 70 million people, and this was deemed to be too large for the Japanese islands alone to feed. And so the colonisation of Korea, Manchuria, Taiwan, and then the later acquisitions of Malaya, Burma, the Philippines, etc., were essential for the maintenance of Japanese living standards. This could only continue as long as the empire was maintained, and obviously from 1943 onwards it begins to collapse. The vulnerability of Japanese shipping after the battles in the Pacific becomes patently obvious. Millions of tons of Japanese shipping are sunk between 1943 and 1945. Sea lanes are essentially lost to Japan, and the empire collapses bit by bit in Southeast Asia, in the Pacific, and in China. And the result is famine in Japan. The entire country is close to mass starvation in 1945, and localized starvation has already begun. In most of Japan's cities, at least half, if not three quarters, of all the housing is destroyed. I think it's nearly 90% in Nagoya, for example. And this meant that MacArthur had the opportunity, and he skillfully plays this, of presenting himself as a rescuer to the Japanese people. He quickly requisitions 3.5 million tons of American army food supplies, tinned beef and that sort of thing. Totally alien to the Japanese diet, but entirely welcome when it arrives. And sets about a massive and very successful relief operation to feed Japan. MacArthur, right to the end of his time in Japan, received tens of thousands of letters of gratitude and gifts from the Japanese people. It might be that an authoritarian figure like MacArthur was, not an unfamiliar character in Japan, so there are reasons why he might have gone down reasonably well there. But he himself barely met any of the people that he ruled. He met a handful of the emperor's ministers. He seems to have had quite a good relationship with Hirohito, and went out of his way to deflect any blame from Hirohito, and to present Hirohito as the kind of the naive victim of his general's machinations, which, as we know, is not an accurate picture of what Hirohito had been doing or how he'd been behaving. There was some talk amongst the few anti-war members of the royal family and ministers at the end of the war of forcing Hirohito's abdication and passing the throne to his 12-year-old son Akihito. But this doesn't come to pass. Instead, Hirohito is managed by MacArthur in order to introduce MacArthur's reforms. There was no small amount of racial conceit with the American occupation. The belief that MacArthur had was that he was bringing enlightened European-style democracy or American-style democracy to a kind of a despotic and backward Asian people who had been liberated now from feudalism and had taken a kind of a giant step forward into modernity, and that there was a kind of a white man's mission to be done in Japan. Inevitably, of course, a colonizing class of American military and civil bureaucrats and a new kind of tier of foreign imposed government would behave as colonizers do in kind of authoritarian and very arrogant ways. They were happy to live off the largesse of the Japanese they occupied for the use of by MacArthur's senior officers, many of the stately homes and houses of the upper classes in Japan, and lived extremely well. This, if resentment was generated amongst the Japanese, this was one of the causes of it. Ordinary GI soldiers were encouraged not to fraternize with Japanese women, but obviously this was something that was almost inevitable, and there were many thousands of American-Japanese babies born after 1946. Though often the two sides discovered that many of the kind of the racist myths peddled about one another astoundingly turned out to not be true. The occupation of Japan was the beginning, really, of an American century or half century in Asia. The occupation of Japan was followed in 1950 by America's involvement in the Korean War, from 1954 onwards by America's involvement in Vietnam. But throughout the 1950s and 1960s, really until the mid to late 1970s, Asia is part of the American sphere of influence. I mean, to some extent, it still is. You know, the if you look at the headlines about tensions over Chinese warships and Obama's shift towards focusing on the Pacific and the and the rise of China in the last 4 or 5 years. But throughout the 60s and 70s, it is unmistakably an American fiefdom. And part of the reason why this goes into decline, I think, is not is firstly to do with the kind of the renaissance of Japan in the 1980s, and then obviously following that, the resurgence of China from the 90s onwards. Okay, well, I'll finish there, and I hope you found this a useful and interesting podcast, as per usual. I just want to mention a couple of things that are coming up. You know, I've mentioned in the past that we are doing podcasts with webinars with Hodder. The new A-level history series that I'm working on that gives teachers some fresh perspectives and energising ideas for their lessons is going to start on October the 19th, when I'm going to be doing a webinar which is going to focus on modern Britain. On November the 2nd, I'll be co-hosting with Alf Wilkinson on Soviet Russia. And then a week later, on the 9th, I'll be co-hosting with Richard Kennett on Nazi Germany. And then finally, on November the 16th, I'll be presenting with Helen Snelson on post-war Germany, 1945 to 1991. So if you subscribe to Explaining History and you're a teacher, you can get a discount on each of these bookings. There's a link that I'm going to put with this podcast. And the promotional code to go with it is WF0009023. But you'll have that in the link. So I hope you find that useful, and I look forward to, if we do, chatting to you in October, November. So catch you on the next podcast. Bye-bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.